United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session. Please be seated.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We have, first of all, Judge Forrest, and I want to express our appreciation to Judge Paul Kelly from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, who is sitting with us today by designation. We're grateful for his volunteering to help us and for his service. We have two matters that we will now submit. They are Martinez-Ramirez versus Garland and Kotler versus Garland. So those matters are now officially submitted. And we'll begin with argument in the case of Abadei, I think, versus Garland. And I believe Ms. Shapansky is the representative petitioner. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly. I apologize. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Katie Sapansky, and I represent petitioner Charles Abadei. I will reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Mr. Abadei presented at the southern U.S. border to seek protection from return to Cameroon and was interviewed. He later passed a credible fear interview and applied for asylum before the IJ while pro se and detained. The immigration judge found Mr. Abadei's testimony not credible because he, one, confused but later corrected and clarified his prior date of departure from Cameroon, and two, because the border interview record only mentioned one of two prior visa denials and did not mention the use of a false name in connection with one of these applications. These inconsistencies on the record, under a totality of the circumstances and relevant factors, did not warrant a negative credibility finding.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Let's state for a moment that the first part is something I probably agree with you on, but I'm really troubled by the fact that the petitioner lied under oath in documents that he signed about the other two matters. Isn't that a prima facie basis on which to find adverse credibility?
No, Your Honor. So regarding the record of the informal interview that does have Mr. Abadei's signature on the bottom, the IJ treated this border interview record as a transcript rather than a summary and afforded it improper weight.
Let's assume it was a summary. He signed it. He signed it under oath, did he not?
He did. And during his testimony,
he signed each page.
He initialed each page, correct.
And then he said never had a chance to look at it.
Yes, Mr. Abadei testified that he did not have an opportunity to review the answers in the document. And further, Mr. Abadei believes that he did inform the border officer that he had used a prior name, and perhaps the officer did not understand him when he told him about the second visa.
But with respect, that's what you're basically saying about everything. I didn't understand this. I didn't understand that. And maybe it works with respect to some of it. But as we've discussed, with respect to these border documents, he initialed each page, he signed each page, and he signed it under oath. In a court of law, let's just say that somebody came down here and signed a document, we'd have a little trouble saying, well, gee, I don't know what I was doing, I didn't look at it. Isn't there some burden on the part of your client to take responsibility for something he does in connection with the service?
Yes, Your Honor. And during his testimony, he did state that he thought he told the officer this. And he said, maybe the officer didn't understand me or he didn't understand.
With respect, again, you're a good lawyer. You know, people will say all kinds of things, but basically he's deflecting everything. I didn't do this. I didn't understand that. I told him this, I told him that, but he didn't write it down. He didn't make any exception to that when he reviewed the pages, initialed them, and signed them under oath. Now, I guess my question boils down to the fact is, you know, even if we cut him some slack with respect to the first portion of the documentation, I'm really troubled by this border documentation. And I don't think the fact that he said later on, oh, I told him that, really overcomes his adverse credibility problem. What am I missing?
So Mr. Abajay did spontaneously admit to the use of this false name and posing with or applying for these visas prior to the final hearing as well.
Isn't that in and of itself an illegal act? Making a claim under a false name?
So under established precedent, though, an individual may, this court has held that an individual may need to provide false information or submit false applications to escape persecution. And that's
that's in Cameroon in this case. I get that. If he were trying to get out of Cameroon, false, I get it. And there are some cases that back that up. But we're not talking about Cameroon here. We're talking about the United States of America. He's here. He makes false claims. I'm sure you've seen these before. We get people all the time say, well, I was married. I did this. I did that. And it's false. And if they sign it under penalty of perjury, it's a problem. And indeed, it is sometimes just completely disqualifying. In this case, it may not be that, but why doesn't it go to the adverse credibility issue?
It doesn't go to the adverse credibility under the totality of the circumstances because Mr. Abajay later clarified this and made admissions to these two visas and his use of a false name. Even in a hearing prior to his final hearing, he made no attempts to evade these questions or mislead the IJ when he was questioned about it in his testimony, counsel, and he confirmed.
Counsel, excuse me. What is our standard of review here?
Yes, so here credibility determinations are made and must be reviewed based on a totality of the circumstances and all relevant factors, not a single factor. This was recently established under Alam v. Garland or clarified by this court. And that court held that there is no bright line rule to the certain number of inconsistencies that are needed to uphold or reject an adverse credibility of finding. The determination should require assessing the totality of the circumstances.
Well, do we owe any deference to the IJ?
There is some, this court may address the IJ's decision. However, under established case law as well, the IJ erred as a matter of law in failing to provide those reasons, cogent reasons for rejecting these explanations for the inconsistency. So the IJ didn't even provide those explanations. So the board didn't have the opportunity to review the IJ's reasoning for rejecting these inconsistencies, for the explanation for the inconsistencies.
So is it your position that the IJ had an obligation to explain why, if your client lied under oath, under penalty of perjury, signing these documents, initialing these documents, he had to explain why that went to adverse credibility?
Well, here the IJ's responsibility was to address why she rejected the reasonable or plausible explanations that Mr. Abajay provided. So he did state that he believed that he told the officer this, and the IJ did not provide an explanation for rejecting.
And again, I'm not suggesting this is the case with your client, but let's just say your client says, I was accosted by Martians and they told me to say this. Does the IJ have to respond to that?
So the IJ must provide a reason for rejecting that explanation from—
Even with the Martian example?
Because it is still, yes, Your Honor, because it is still plausible that the respondent believes that to be true.
That's interesting. That takes us to a whole new level. It's the Twilight Zone.
So thank you, Your Honor. I noticed that I have 2 minutes. I would like to—
Want to save your time?
Thank you.
That'd be fine. Let's hear from the government.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Good morning. Joanna Watson on behalf of respondent, the United States Attorney General. And under the totality of the circumstances, substantial evidence supports the agency's adverse credibility determination. And I know a lot of the focus has been on the omissions at the border, and I'll get to that, but I really want to go over the inconsistent testimony about the second time that Mr. Abajay left Cameroon. I mean, this wasn't a situation where he said one time an incorrect date and fixed it. The immigration judge provided him six or seven opportunities to provide the date that he had previously provided. He had stated in his declaration that he had left in April of 2019. But the immigration judge asked him, the first time he asked him, and Mr. Abagé responded that it was December 2016. And then a second time, the IJ said December 2016, and he confirmed that that was the date. And then another time, he asked him again whether the second time he left was in December 2016. And then he even pointed out that where would he have been between December 2016 and when he arrived in United States in 2019? And that's when he went into the discussion of being in Yaounde. And he was repeatedly, again, you know, the immigration judge pointed out the confusion that, you know, on the record at AR 146, 147, he says, I have some confusion then. The first time I asked you when you left Cameroon, the second time, you told me December 2016. And then the second time you said December 2018. And now you're telling me that you're arrested in December of 2018 and held for 5 months. And this is a huge discrepancy here, because if it was December 2016 when he initially said, or December 2018, he would have already departed at the time that he claims that he was detained. So, I mean, I know that I recognize in the 28 day under Alam that the court is not required any longer. The one factor rule is no longer in play, but there's no bright line rule. And this is a huge discrepancy here in dates. And when you have that on top of the omissions that were made at the border, and to that matter, when you're talking about an immigration judge providing an opportunity to explain omissions or inconsistencies, that can happen through cross-examination. And that's exactly what happened here when the government attorney asked Mr. Abagé about the omissions, and he confirmed that his initials were on the pages of that interview, that he initialed every page and that he signed every page, and that so he understood the question.
Can I go back to the Cameroon inconsistencies for a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
As you look at the record, it's hard to see how he really benefited from the inconsistencies that were in that explanation, or those various explanations. Does it matter for purposes of making an adverse credibility determination whether the inconsistencies would or would not have been helpful to the petitioner in this case?
I'm not quite sure I'm understanding your question. How it wouldn't matter that he couldn't have been detained if he already left.
Let's just say that he misrepresented several things, but the fact is the reason he came here, he said he was persecuted and the like, and he wants to be believed. But say that he said, I couldn't go because I couldn't get Kool-Aid, or I couldn't go because my mother wanted me to have dinner with her, or whatever. And a whole bunch of things that had absolutely no impact on the case. Can an IJ still make an adverse credibility determination based upon inconsistencies that are not material to the issues before the agency?
Under the Real ID Act, it's a totality of the circumstances, and it can rely on any inconsistency or omission. But of course, inconsistencies and omissions that go to the heart of the claim are going to weigh more. But you can still look at any inconsistencies. But this particular one, where, you know, he only left Cameroon twice and he gave inconsistent dates repeatedly, until the immigration judge pointed out that you wouldn't have been detained. You couldn't have been detained if you had left in December of 2018, because he claimed in his declaration that he was detained from December of 2018 until April of 2019, and then he left for the United States after being released. So, I mean, that's a huge factor here. And, you know, there's no bright line on how many factors, but this one is pretty large.
On top of
the fact that the omissions that were made at the border as well.
Which do you think is more important? The fact that he lied about being married and having a job in one of his applications, for the fact that he was confused, if you will, or that he initialed each page and claimed he didn't read any of it. You just put them all together and come up.
That's why it's the totality of the circumstances. And there's not, and the court and all of them said that, you know, there's no longer, you know, this one factor, substantial evidence supports this one factor, you know, the court's not required any longer. You need, it's not saying that one factor isn't going to be, won't ever be sufficient, just saying that you look at the totality of the circumstances. And when you look at this totality, you know, it supports the adverse credibility determination when you look at all these factors together, particularly. So I wouldn't say that one more than the other, and in looking at, you know, the false visa in Cameroon, the omissions he made, he says that he got one, he tried to get one visa but was denied, and then he says that he never used a false name. But we don't even know which visa he's talking about when he says that he only got one, whether he's referring to the one for college or the other one in this case.
Counsel, would you address the CAT claim? In my review of the record, I don't see that the agency addressed the country conditions that were part of the record. And I'm just wondering, under our case law, whether we have to remand for it to do that. Because there's no reference to it that I see.
There wasn't a whole lot of reference. I mean, the immigration judge discussed the evidence that was in the record that, you know, it shows that he looked at the country reports and everything. I think at the beginning of the decision, it goes over the exhibits and everything. But
So I read that whole transcript, and I saw at the very beginning, because the IJ's decision was an oral decision. Mm-hmm. So it's a transcript. I saw at the very beginning of that there's basically the list. Here's exhibit one, and here's exhibit two, and here's exhibit three. I didn't see anything in there about, and I've considered all of these things, and there certainly I didn't see any specific discussion of, you know, I've looked at the country information of record and I find it unpersuasive or whatever. So can you give me a record site that shows that the IJ did something more than just list that it was in the record?
It doesn't go into a lot of detail about the country conditions, because the denial of CAT is primarily based on the adverse credibility determination. The immigration
our case law says that even if you have somebody who is deemed not credible, if there's relevant country conditions in the record, the agency still has to look at that, because you can have a CAT claim even if somebody's not credible, right?
Correct. That is correct, but it goes to like the, when you're looking at past torture, if you're found not credible, then, you know, you look at, the IJ looked at it in terms of, there was nothing in the record to show that the government had any interest in him, because he testified that when he was released from custody that second time, he didn't have to report again. And the government was fully aware that his brother was in Spain. And, you know, he wasn't a member of the party that his brother was a member of. And there's nothing in the record to show that anybody had any interest in him when he returned.
Or are you suggesting that when it's not relevant, that you don't really need to worry about it?
Well, I mean, there's between the adverse credibility determination and no evidence that it's more likely than not that anybody would have any interest in torturing him.
You could have
information in the record that shows that not the best conditions in the country, but you have to show under your specific situation that it would be more likely than not that you'd be tortured by the government or with the acquiescence.
Here's the scenario that I can't figure out how we resolve it. It could be, I don't read the agency's decisions, even though they find him not credible, I don't read those decisions as them concluding that his family wasn't a part of this disfavored political organization. So he was found not credible on some things, but it's not like every single thing he said they didn't believe. I just don't think I can read the record that way. So if it's true that the agency was accepting that his brother and father had this connection to this political organization, even without specific evidence that they're actively looking for him now, there could be information in country conditions reports that say that people associated with such a political organization are being treated unfavorably. So I'm back to, isn't it possible, even if they don't believe everything he said about what happened to him personally, that there's enough in this record to say he's connected to some sort of political, disfavored political organization, that he might have trouble and we would need to look at the country conditions?
Well, I mean, when you have the adverse credibility determination that's here, I mean, it's...
So is your reading of the record that the agency concluded that his brother and father weren't even connected to that organization? Is that your reading of the record?
No, they were.
They didn't explicitly say that, but they didn't explicitly say that, you know, they believed that they were members of this party and believed any parts of his story because of the inconsistency during his testimony and everything. It cast doubt on everything.
We've gone over time, but we can always ask questions, and I am concerned about this. The country reports are usually, if you will, documents that can be used as documents of advocacy by the petitioner. But the petitioner, in order for it to be useful, has to point out in the country report what it is that the petitioner thinks would benefit him or her. The government, on the other hand, usually uses these as a way to say you can relocate somebody within the country and get away without having a CAT relief granted. In this case, does the record reflect that the petitioner cited something in particular in the country report that would be beneficial to him, as opposed to saying there are gangs? Everybody from Central America says there are gangs, and the country reports say that, but it doesn't help them because they have to particularize it with respect to their own situation. Is there anything in this record that suggests that the petitioner met his burden to show that the country report would be of assistance to him? And if so, did the agency respond to that specific allegation?
I mean, the records are in here, but he didn't have very much of an argument for his CAT claim, except for that he was allegedly detained and harmed while he was detained.
I'm asking is, did he cite anything in the country report, other than just, here's a country report? Did he say in the country report there was something there that buttressed his claim?
No, there's no citation to the country reports and the opening brief.
Is that relevant or is that required in order for him to benefit from the agency's BIA in this case?
Failure
to address it?
It's his burden to show that he warrants protection. And it's a large, heavy burden.
I understand that. My question is so there's a country report in. Every case has a country report. Most of them are absolutely no worth. We don't deal with them. We don't touch them. Unless somebody comes forward and says, this condition in the country affects me. And my question is, in this case, did the petitioner cite something in the country report that said that affected him? And if he did, is there a failure on the part of the BIA or the IJ to address that?
Well, again, the country reports, you're speaking in terms of an appeal to the board or during,
I'm just saying it in this proceeding, if the country report was there, did the petitioner cite something specifically in the country report that he felt was beneficial to his case?
Doesn't point to anything in the opening brief, and there was a minimal argument in his appeal to the board.
What was that argument with respect to the country report?
Do you not have the appeal brief with me? I believe it was primarily, again, what happened to him, and then it would happen again because...
Well, so you're saying basically you don't know for sure about that question, right?
I could... Submit a 28-J.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah, but I'm just saying right now you don't know. Okay. Do either of my colleagues have additional questions?
I want to be candid with the court, and I don't want to say something that I can't be definitive about.
Understand. Do either of my colleagues have additional questions for the government? Okay, very well. Let's go back then to counsel for petitioner. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd quickly like to address the issue of the dates of departure that were addressed in Mr. Abajay's testimony. The event in his testimony was the first instance of this date confusion in what has otherwise had been a consistent detail in his record. He gave the same dates in his border interview, in the credible fear interview, in his sworn I-589 and his declaration. And from the several months that he entered the United States and appeared before the immigration judge, he had provided the same dates. It was after 4 months of being detained and appearing pro se before the judge did he make that mistake, but then corrected it, provided the date of April 9th or April 2019 twice to the immigration judge. And the immigration judge did not inquire for an explanation for the confusion or give a reason for rejecting Mr. Abajay's correction of this date.
Opposing counsel suggested that your client said he was departing when he also said he was being detained in Cameroon. Did I misunderstand that?
No, Your Honor. So at first, Mr. Abajay confused the dates 2016 and 2018. And then when the judge asked to clarify, Mr. Abajay explained it was December 2018 when he was arrested and was released from the custody on April 2019, in which he fled the very next day or perhaps the same day. He was confusing the date of his arrest with the date of his departure.
Opposing counsel suggests that the IJ had given your client repeated opportunities to correct the record, and the more he said, the more confused it got. That's what I understood her to say. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is that Mr. Abajay did correct the record. He corrected it, said April of 2019. And actually further along in the proceedings, when the judge asked him again what was the date that he fled, he said April 9th of 2019. So he actually said the correct date twice in his testimony as well. The second time, without an error, was on page 156 of the transcript. I can briefly conclude, Your Honors.
We're over time, so let me ask my colleagues whether either has additional questions for the petitioner's counsel. All right. Thank you both for your argument in this somewhat confusing case. So we appreciate that, and the case just argued is submitted.